For to us a child is born, to us a son is given. This child, Jesus Christ, is the focus of every Christmas card that Emmanuel Press offers. Whether in stained glass, illumination, or classic works of art, Christmas cards from Emmanuel Press joyfully confess our Savior's birth with the words of Scripture and the poetry of hymns. Visit their website at emmanuelpress.us to create a custom assortment of cards. EmmanuelPress.us.
These people who are going nuts, screaming at the Supreme Court, pounding on the doors, and doing the same thing at colleges, what happens on campus is not going to stay on campus. It is going to infect the mainstream of our politics.
Most school boards are not responsive to parents any longer, so it's not the same public school. And the game changer really has been just this promotion of the LGBT culture.
When is grace ever not radical? So why do you need to qualify it with the word radical? What's the itch you're trying to scratch here?
These forms of worship come with an inherent enthusiastic theology that is diametrically opposed to the sacraments and the means of grace.
I'm a harpist in Arkansas, and I love Issues, etc.
I imagine the average Christian in pop American Christianity reading about this bishop from the first and second century in a town they probably would recognize if they know their Bible or their Book of Acts. The Book of Acts has Christians gathered very early in the Syrian town of Antioch. Reading about this man might set them back a little bit. He believed some crazy things, at least to their way of thinking. He believed in the bodily presence of Jesus in the Eucharist. He believed that Jesus Christ was at the same time both God and man. We just learned from a survey that most Christians in America are kind of mixed up on that very issue. He believed that martyrdom was a good thing, and he actually came close to begging for it at times, and he wrote to many churches on his way to his martyrdom, Ignatius of Antioch. We're going to be remembering him as the church does on this day. Greetings and welcome to Issues, Etc., coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Pastor Heath Curtis joins us to talk about Ignatius of Antioch. A little bit later, Scott Klusendorf will be alongside to discuss a column in The Atlantic on women suffering from illegal abortion. It concedes women won't necessarily die, but they will suffer. It's interesting. It reads like a case against medicinal abortion. It paints a pretty dangerous picture of those drugs that are already all too common here in the U.S. and worldwide. Then Pastor Tom Baker will join us to teach a Sunday school lesson on the Passover in Exodus chapters 11 and 12, and Pastor Jonathan Fisk will round everything off. Part 6 of our series on Proverbs today, wisdom as easy to find but hard to accept. Join us with questions or comments. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-MYIE. Our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org. Our Twitter address, @issuesetc. And the Issues Etc. listener comment line, 618-223-8382. Joining us to remember first and second century Bishop Ignatius of Antioch, Pastor Heath Curtis. He's pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in Warden, Illinois, and Zion Lutheran Church in Carpenter, Illinois. He's coordinator for LCMS Stewardship and author of the book Ordering Our Days in His Peace, An Introduction to the Christian Church Year. Heath, welcome back.
Always good to be with you, Todd.
Is he as early as we go with these well-known apostolic fathers, as they're called, as close to the apostles as you can get?
Yeah, pretty much. Now, the interesting thing about Ignatius is there's a very interesting history of his correspondence, these letters that we have that go under the name of Ignatius, and it's still a very hot topic today as to which of those letters is authentic and which aren't, and are any of them authentic. And this will get us into a bit of interesting discussion about the differences between how Roman Catholics and Protestants view history and the historical task, perhaps a little bit today. But there's no doubt that Ignatius of Antioch existed, and there's no doubt that he was martyred for his faith. everybody mentions him as a famous early martyr, because Antioch was one of the four key cities in the Roman Empire of his day. If we place his death during the reign of Emperor Trajan, who is known all throughout late antiquity as one of the best Roman emperors. And the fascinating thing about Trajan is that we have letters between Emperor Trajan and one of his governors, the governor of Bithynia, Pliny the Younger, about how to deal with these Christians. And again, Trajan was known as one of the best Roman emperors. In later Roman history, whenever an emperor was invested into office, one of the prayers given for him was that he would be better, even better than Trajan. You know, Trajan was just the best guy. He kept the army in check, the people were prosperous and relatively free, and the empire was at its farthest boundaries in the days of Trajan, and he is the guy who said, you know, thus far and no farther. So as far as earthly things are concerned, you can't do better than Trajan. But he doesn't like these Christians, just as all kind of upper crust Romans of his day didn't. And Pliny, one of his, again, everybody knows Pliny the Younger and Pliny the Elder. Pliny the Elder is Pliny the Younger's uncle, and he's the guy who goes on the rescue operation during the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. And Pliny the Younger tells that story about his famous uncle. Well, at any rate, in his own career, Pliny the Younger ends up as the governor of Bithynia up in what is today Turkey. And he writes a letter to Trajan saying, what am I supposed to do with these Christians? People come in and they accuse their neighbors or their friends of saying, you know, this guy's a Christian. You know, he's part of this weird religion. We need to get rid of him. And Trajan says, you know, I don't want you out there searching for Christians. We don't want to go on one of these, you know, big, pogroms or something. You know, that's de classe. You know, if people want to have a weird religion and they keep it to themselves, fine. And we also don't want people doing, you know, witch hunts against their neighbors. So if somebody accuses somebody of being a Christian, just ask the person accused, you know, offer a little incense to the emperor, and we'll call it good. But of course, the Christians won't do that. You know, we won't offer any obeisance to any foreign gods. We worship the one God in three persons, and three persons in one God, and that's it. So Trajan says something along the lines of, you know, but if they're going to be obstinate, if they won't just, you know, go along to get along, as far as this very basic civil religion is concerned, well, then, yeah, you're going to have to kill them, because that's not the kind of people we want in the Roman Empire. And so this is the world in which Ignatius lived. And again, the details are kind of fuzzy as to one of the writings about Ignatius that is almost certainly not genuine is called The Martyrdom of Ignatius. So that's probably not genuine. Somebody writes that long after the fact, doesn't probably recount the exact details of how he is killed. But we do have another very early document concerning the martyrdom of a Christian that is absolutely authentic, and that's called The Martyrdom of Polycarp, P-O-L-Y-C-A-R-P. That's worth folks looking up online and reading, The Martyrdom of Polycarp. It's fascinating. It's from the same kind of era, and that one is an authentic document, eyewitness account of how this other bishop, Polycarp, came to his demise as a martyr for the Christian faith. So Ignatius lived during the same time. So let's put his death in roughly the year 117, A.D. 117. And he is the bishop of this large city, Antioch, very important city. And so his martyrdom was a big deal and was certainly noticed in the early church. And it's absolutely conceivable that Ignatius heard some of the apostles preach, probably especially St. John, but maybe also St. Luke. As a young person, perhaps he heard these apostles speak. And so it's fascinating to know what we know about him as this character who kind of bridges from the apostolic era into what we think of as the early church.
These writings that are attributed to him, and we can't deal with all the kind of pseudo-Ignatius writings that are out there, but are there ones that are most certainly rightly attributed to him?
This is a big big piece of controversy from the time of the Reformation. So let's say you're somebody like John Calvin or you're Martin Luther, and you're living in the 16th century. What we have are a collection of 13 letters that are supposedly from St. Ignatius. Well, as time goes on, during the time of the Reformation, various Protestant scholars looked at these and said, you know, this sounds kind of fishy. This doesn't sound like the second century. And sure enough, there are 15, and at least 8 of those letters are absolutely, positively forgeries. And they're, you know, talking up essentially what we would think of as Roman Catholic points of doctrine. So we're left with these 7 letters, and these are, if you buy a copy of the Apostolic Fathers, which is a great book, you can get a translation, and if you're a preacher-type person who reads New Testament Greek, you can get a bilingual version, Greek on one page and English on the other. It's very handy. The editor is Lightfoot, a guy named Lightfoot. And they're fascinating to read. And so the controversy is this. The only time they're quoted in ancient resources is by Origen. He only quotes them a couple times. And early Protestant scholars surmise that, hey, maybe these were actually written by Pope Calixtus. And again, this is getting down in the weeds. What's the takeaway for the average Christian when it comes to these letters? Well, let's assume they are authentic, these 7 letters. Well, then, as you noted in your opening monologue, all the big Christian doctrines are there that you would expect. That Christ is one person with 2 natures, that, you know, Ignatius uses the phrase, you know, the blood of God. Well, that's also in Acts chapter 20, right, that God redeemed the church with his own blood. And so it's he's got a very Pauline way of talking. He talks a lot like Paul and also a lot like John, you know, so he says, you know, God is love, and he kind of talks the same way that we see the Gospel of John or the Epistles of John talking. The controversial point is that Ignatius talks a whole lot about the bishop and the bishop as distinct from the presbyter or elder or priest, all those words being the same thing, and the deacons. And Roman Catholics would point to these letters and say, see, you crazy Protestants, you dare not get rid of the bishops, the episcopal structure of the church with a pope at the top, and then filtering down through the bishops throughout all the dioceses all around the world. And Protestants kind of had 2 responses. So I'll give you both responses. One is, give me a break. These letters sound way more like they're written in the 3rd or 4th century. We already know half of the letters going under Ignatius are fake. All these letters got to be fake. Ignatius was a famous guy, and somebody later tried to use his name to get across his teaching. Okay, that'd be one response. That's John Calvin's response. He rejects all of them. On the other hand, and I think this is a little more persuasive, it strengthens the Protestant case to view the 7 letters as authentic and then point out, look what Ignatius is doing in the 2nd century. He's having to argue for his view of the bishop. And he's having to argue very strongly, and he's actually talking about and giving evidence that there are churches all throughout the empire that don't act the way he thinks bishops ought to act. They act, when it comes to bishops and presbyters, the same way we see bishops and presbyters talked about, like in 1 Timothy 3, where they're the same thing. Just very clearly, if you look at 1 Timothy 3 and Titus chapter 1, it's very clear that bishop and presbyter are the same office. And so if you view Ignatius as authentic, what he's giving us a window into is this transitional period where now it's becoming kind of hardened, but there ought to be a man at the top. There ought to be a guy, and he's arguing for a distinction between bishop and presbyter, but while he's arguing for it, he's showing us that people are actually not living that way, which is an indication that that's actually the older biblical teaching that we see in Paul's epistles. So Protestants have viewed it in those 2 ways, and I hope the letters are authentic, because I think that second argument that I laid out is a very strong argument that the Lutheran or Presbyterian way of viewing the development in the church from what we see in Paul's epistles to what we have, say, in the days of Augustine in the 5th century, I think that if the letters of Ignatius are authentic, that actually bolsters the Protestant case quite a bit.
Pastor Heath Curtis is our guest. We're talking about 1st and 2nd century Bishop Ignatius of Antioch. We'll talk more with him on the other side of the break about some of the things that are attributed to him, like referring to the Eucharist as the medicine of immortality and using the word Catholic in a way that, well, the church has always used the word Catholic, but in his case, for the first time. Stay tuned.
We Lutherans were never aided by following along with some other tradition's theological priorities and catchphrases.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Pastor Heath Curtis, coordinator for stewardship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod on a Lutheran approach to stewardship.
Other folks are not approaching it from our good, solid Lutheran understanding of law and gospel and vocation. There's a place to talk about this in Christianity, and we have a way of talking about stewardship as Lutherans without ever using the word stewardship, if you like. I'm going to talk to you today about your vocation in your home, in your church, in your society, and how each one of these makes a claim on you, on your presence, on your support, on your prayers. That's how we should talk about this as Lutherans.
You'll find several stewardship resources at lcms.org/stewardship, lcms.org/stewardship.
The faith once for all delivered to the saints. You're listening to Issues Etc.
It is the greatest adventure you could ever possibly imagine. It's demanding, it's hard, it's challenging, and what a blessing it is.
Dr. Larry Rast, president of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on why a man should consider the vocation of pastor.
And it is an incredible blessing to be honored with the opportunity to work with these incredible young men and older men as well, who are committing themselves to the proclamation of God's word, the right distinction of law and gospel, and to take the good news of Jesus Christ into all the world.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, forming servants in Jesus Christ who teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about 1st and 2nd century Bishop and Martyr Ignatius of Antioch. The church remembers him on October 17th. Pastor Curtis is author of the book Ordering Our Days in His Peace, An Introduction to the Christian Church here. You'll find a link to this at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Call Concordia Publishing House and ask for the book as well. 1-800-325-3040. So, assuming that the seven of these letters that are usually attributed to him are authentic, he is said to have written them while in chains on his way to Rome, being tried, a trial that would ultimately end in his martyrdom. I think he was thrown to the wild beasts, a rather gruesome way to die. There are several things in there that stand out. You mentioned one before, and that is his argument in favor of the office of bishop. And another one is his view of the Eucharist. How would you describe that?
Well, he has a very, we would say, a realistic view of the Eucharist, of the Lord's Supper, that he's very comfortable talking very clearly about how in the Lord's Supper we really receive the body and blood of Jesus. And also, as you mentioned, his famous quote, you know, that it is the medicine of immortality, that the gifts that are given to us through Holy Communion are life and salvation, forgiveness of sins, and wherever there's forgiveness of sins, there's life and immortality, the medicine of immortality. So you can hear Luther in the Small Catechism also kind of riffing on this same way of speaking about the Eucharist. And this is characteristic of these seven epistles of Ignatius, is a very direct manner of speech. a very clear teaching. You never have to wonder what these epistles of Ignatius are getting at. They're very straightforward, and they're fun to read in that way. And again, for the preachers in the audience or anybody else who deals with a little bit of New Testament Greek, they're fun also to look at in Greek because they, it's relatively straightforward, and all these great editions of them are readily available in Greek and English together.
He also uses this adjective Catholic with respect to the Christian church, which is widely misunderstood today. How did he understand it? How did the earliest church understand the nature of the church in that respect?
Sure. That one of the arguments of the church was trying to make in this early stage of the church was whenever some weird group would crop up and say, hey, we're followers of Jesus, one of the easiest ways to respond to that would be to say, well, but what you're teaching isn't Catholic, which means universal, which means it's taught everywhere. You know, you guys are making up some, you know, weird little local variation of Christianity, and that's not right. It's not Catholic. It's not what the whole church teaches. What you're doing is kind of, you know, an offshoot off on a, you know, you're out on a limb. And this is why it's so interesting to read the first Lutheran confession of the faith that is put together. It's called the Augsburg Confession. And it's divided into two parts. There are 21 articles that deal with, you know, the basics of Christianity. Who is God? What is sin? What is baptism? What's the Lord's Supper? You know, really nuts and bolts stuff, 21 articles. And then there are 7 articles at the end of the Augsburg Confession that deal with what the early Lutherans, and this is in the year 1530, what they're dealing with as far as controversies. So it's, you know, there's an article on whether or not you should fast from eating meat on Fridays, you know, on foods. There's an article on the power of bishops. There's an article on, you know, what to do with monastic vows. In between those two statements, those two lists, here are the basics and here are these, you know, things that we're arguing about. After that list of the basics, the Lutherans say, now listen, you guys can see that we're not teaching anything that isn't common to the Catholic Church and even to the Roman Church, judging by your writers. We're well within the mainstream. That might be a pretty good translation of how Ignatius and other early writers used the word Catholic. Today we'd probably say in the mainstream. You know, this is in the mainstream of Christian teaching. We're not weird. We're not heretics. You guys disagree with us and we disagree with you on whether or not we ought to have, you know, monastic vows. But, I mean, it's clear there are no monastic vows in the New Testament. But this is what we teach about baptism. This is what we teach about the Lord's Supper. And it's that kind of meaning that the phrase has, let's call it mainstream, as opposed to, as you said, there's confusion about the term, because what the term means today in modern everyday English is the institutional church with a guy named Francis in Rome sitting at the top of the pyramid hierarchical structure. And in that case, well, obviously Presbyterians aren't Catholic, Lutherans aren't Catholic, Orthodox aren't Catholic, because we're not under, you know, Francis's administration. But what the term originally means is, you know, hey, Christianity, what the Bible says, the mainstream of Christian thought, just what we've always taught and what we've always done, and all you people making up new weird things, you guys are off the reservation.
When we look at Ignatius and the manner of his death, how much can we trust of, I know that you said earlier that there's a late account of his martyrdom that was probably just penned from legend, but are we certain he was martyred? Are we certain he was tossed to the wild beast? Every depiction of him has him in the clutches of one or two lions.
Yes, yeah, I mean, that does seem to be authentic, that he is a martyr, and Polycarp mentions that he's thrown to the wild beast. So that seems to be authentic, but we don't have an account of it the way that we have a detailed first-person account of the martyrdom of Polycarp. So we know from other sources what that was like, how Christians were used for entertainment along with other criminals in the arena, and sometimes the wild beast, sometimes in gladiatorial expositions, and he seems to be one who was killed by wild animals. A gruesome thing indeed.
He's known through those writings as not only having little fear of what he believed would be his eventual martyrdom, but kind of anxious to undergo it. What is going on in the mind of these early Christians?
Yeah, there are a couple times in early Christian works where writers, preachers are very careful to preach to people, hey, don't go out seeking martyrdom. You don't get to go turn yourself in to try to be a martyr. And that might seem kind of very odd to us, but there was a great amount of, there was a great desire to be found faithful. There was a great desire to say, hey, I'm a Christian. I'm not ashamed of it. I'm not afraid of it. As a matter of fact, I am very happy to be a Christian. I'm happy to have everybody know it. And in an environment where, with good reason, the martyrs were lifted up to the people as great signs of faith, as great encouragement, like it says in the Epistle to the Hebrews, right? This great, in chapters 10 and 11, this great cloud of witnesses that's gone before us. Or again, in the book of Revelation, the martyrs have a special place, around the throne and this vision of heaven, and they cry out, how long until you avenge us, O Lord? And so the status of martyrdom was held up in the church, and some people, wanted to seek that out for themselves. They were ready to, I'm a Christian, I'm a believer, I'm in this situation where the government is persecuting the church, I want to be first in line to die for my Lord. And so early Christian writers often spent some time saying, hey, listen, you don't get to pick your own crosses. There are enough crosses in life that God is going to hand you. You don't get to go out and pick your own. And then this gets us back again to something that St. Paul says, the Christian should strive to lead a quiet life, and as far as it depends on you, live at peace with all men. But when push comes to shove, of course you're going to stand up for your faith and say, of course I'm a Christian, I'm not going to deny my Lord. But you shouldn't seek that out, because then you're tempting the Lord. Because it is, I can't imagine being put on the line and for Flannery O'Connor, a great American Roman Catholic writer of literature, she's got a great line in one of her short stories about the difference between a martyr and a confessor. A confessor is tortured for their faith, and a martyr is somebody who's killed. A confessor lives after being tortured or whatever. And the character in one of her short stories says, don't think I could ever be a confessor. Don't think I could ever stand up to the torture, but I could be a martyr if they killed me quick.
So finally, with about 30 seconds, what would you say is the best way for the church to remember this very early apostolic father, Ignatius, Bishop of Antioch?
To remember him as one of these authentic martyrs who died for the faith in the shadow of the apostles. And so I like thinking of him as a link in a chain. And because this is, who knows what the next 30 years of American life will be like as far as our religion is concerned and how accepted it will be publicly and how much it will be persecuted. And I think a lot of that is up in the air right now. And so for us to remember, this is passed down generation to generation. Who knows exactly what the Lord has in mind for our generation to do, what we'll suffer, what the great highlights of our generation will be. But one thing we know we're going to need to be, like St. Ignatius, is a link in the chain, handing this off from one generation to the next, being faithful in whatever situation the Lord gives us to be faithful in.
Before we let you go, if you would, you are coordinator for LCMS Stewardship. Tell us about it.
Hey, if you want to see a lot of great stewardship resources, you should go to lcms.org/stewardship. Myself and the assistant coordinator, Reverend Nathan Metter, One of the big things we do is we travel all around the Synod doing workshops on stewardship, on demographics, on the stewardship of your congregation and how you respond to the community around you and how you're going to plan to get all these things together. And so tomorrow I'm leaving for Kansas to go do one of these workshops in Wamego, Kansas. We were just up in Chicago doing one of these workshops. If you are interested in that, you can contact me at heath.curtis@lcms.org. And would love to get out to your circuit. We do these at the circuit or bi-circuit level and talk about stewardship, talk about demographics, talk about faithfully meeting the challenges that your congregation has to meet.
You can learn more about LCMS Stewardship Ministry at lcms.org/stewardship. Managing the gifts God gives us. LCMS Stewardship Ministry, lcms.org/stewardship. Pastor Heath Curtis is pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in Warden, Illinois, and Zion Lutheran Church in Carpenter, Illinois. He's coordinator for LCMS Stewardship and author of the book, Ordering Our Days in His Peace, An Introduction to the Christian Church Year. Heath, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ted.
When we come back, there's an article in The Atlantic recently written that if abortion is made illegal, women won't die. A lot of people are claiming they will, but based upon studies of other countries where abortion is illegal to one degree or another, they say, no, it's not likely they'll die, but they'll still be hurt. It's interesting. The column reads like, in some ways, like a pro-life document against the dangers to women of medicinal abortion. We'll talk about it with Scott Klusendorf, president of Life Training Institute, next.
Church music directors can find a new community at Prelude to Postlude, the CPH music blog. Learn helpful tips for managing music ministry and involving members, and meet the composers of some of your favorite new pieces. Plus, find suggestions of music to use for special services, and preview some of our newest works with free samples you can use at your church. Visit us at preludetopostlude.org.
If you're visiting Frankenmuth, Michigan, come to Emmanuel Lutheran Church in nearby Frankentroth. A hardy band of German missionaries founded Emmanuel Frankentrost in the wilderness near Saginaw. At Emmanuel, you can still hear the law and gospel in a beautiful liturgical service, just like those first settlers. For directions and divine service times, visit frankentrost.org. That's FrankenTrost.org.
Concordia University Chicago is a distinctive, comprehensive university of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. We're committed to increasing LCMS faculty and staff members. This is Dr. Daniel Gard, president of Concordia University Chicago. If you are a member of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod with excellent professional credentials, please consider applying for our faculty or staff family. Current openings are posted at cuchicago.edu/HR.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority, they've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
Sacramental, historical, liturgical. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century.
O come, O come, Emmanuel.
The 16th century. The 21st century.
As my father's
the best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.